Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we begin this morning with the shooting of this 21-month-year-old kid on Lakeshore Drive yesterday, and of course what it speaks to in terms of where the city of Chicago is at and the dissent that continues, starting with public safety, but of course not limited to public safety. This is what the representative from Lurie Children's Hospital had to say about the almost two-year-old's condition when he was brought to the hospital by a Good Samaritan.
The child sustained a bullet wound to the head. He is in critical condition. He's currently being hospitalized in our pediatric intensive care unit here at Lurie. He's requiring full critical care support. And we thank you for your concern during this time. He is in grave condition.
What was that at the end of the sentence?
He's in grave condition.
Full critical care support.
So he's currently requiring full ICU support, so he's requiring a ventilator, and we're just ensuring that we can treat him through these injuries to the best of our ability.
Yeah, he was shot in the head.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, shot in the head, and he was in the back seat of a car, in a car seat, and apparently there's a man driving the car and the mom in front, and they got into a road rage incident with another man with Michigan plates. That's what we know, and that man is being questioned this morning. And 15 rounds were fired, back and forth, all the way from, it started at Soldier Field, Dan, and it ended right at Balboa. So they were going back and forth, and Lori Lightfoot, Mayor Lightfoot, talked about
Before we get to Lightfoot, let's hear from police on this so we can set sort of the factual case before we get to the demagogues. Commander Jacob Alderden is Chicago Police Department, described what happened.
An apparent road rage incident. There was an incident that occurred at Waldron and Lakeshore Drive, which escalated into shots being fired for approximately two blocks on North Lakeshore Drive from approximately 1100 to 900 South. Tragically, in this, there was a two-year-old child that was struck in the head. That child's vehicle that it was in then proceeded north on Lakeshore Drive, crashed at Monroe and Lakeshore Drive, at which time a Good Samaritan took the victim as well as the other occupants of the vehicle to Northwestern Hospital. The two-year-old child was then transferred to Lurie's and is in critical condition at this time. There was one weapon recovered from an occupant that was traveling in the vehicle with the victim.
Yeah, so
it's an important point because as you were raising, this was a shootout apparently that went back and forth between the two cars. So the guy who was being questioned is one culpable party, but you're opening fire with a kid in your car. The mom or the adults in the car with the kid have some questions answered too.
I mean, this is the Wild West, and this happened, guys, an hour before Kamala.
Wasn't this wild?
Right. I mean, I'm scared to go downtown. Everyone's scared. This is ridiculous. If this is happening now and it's kind of warm out, wait till the summer. This place is going to be a powder keg. It is going to explode with homicides. There's no respect for human life. If you have a child, that is a great responsibility. If you're a gun owner, that is a great responsibility, and you cannot abuse that because you get mad because somebody cuts you off. What is wrong with people? There's no regard for human life anymore, and that's what Lightfoot was saying. Why are we shooting in between cars?
As I understand it, this small child was in a car seat in the back of the car, and they were shooting going from that car and coming to that car. That doesn't make any sense to me. You know, someone once said to me, and I think it's right, that children are the product of the adult ecosystem around them. I just hope that we are smarter and more committed to making sure that we set the example for our children.
This child is that the kid's name is Caden. He's about to celebrate his second birthday, and he's on a ventilator right now.
This is such an interesting comment. The children are the product of the adult ecosystem around them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a real indictment of the adult ecosystem around them, isn't it? Triple threat. And I'm sorry. Does that include you? Does that start with you? What were the stats in Chicago last year in terms of public safety? What happened in Chicago last year under Lori Lightfoot's stewardship, reimagining policing and so forth, reimagining along with her colleague and cohort, Kim Fox, reimagining the enforcement of law? What was it?
Yeah. There's no consequences for people's actions, Dan. So
55% increase.
Yep.
274 more homicides, 1,435 more shootings in 2020. And we're tracking for a year very similar to 2020 and 2021. So we're making the adjustments on the fly, are we?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The adult ecosystem around adult you. How about the other side of this? Talking about Chicago police. We mentioned the story when CBS broke it, and CBS followed up with Anjanette Young last week. We haven't gotten to it, but now's the perfect time. Anjanette Young, remember the pounding her little elfin shoe on the lectern about the Anjanette Young incident? This is where police got the wrong house,
great.
And they barged in. Miss Young, a social worker, was not clothed. They got the wrong place. They thought she was a drug dealer, or it was the home of a drug dealer. Again, wrong address. It was their fault. She was completely innocent, Miss Young. And because of the body cam video, the CBS obtained it, despite the city trying to block them from obtaining it. The city over which Lori Lightfoot presides tried to block
CBS
News from getting the body cam camera footage to present this to the public. This is not an indictment of police, but it's police. You made a mistake, bad mistake. And there needs to be justice for the victim of that mistake.
Right, but the cover-up was worse than the crime. I mean, going to court, she saw a tease on the news and went to court to try and stop a story from being aired. That is communist country kind of stuff.
And she made a big pronouncement about how she was going to meet with Miss Young and how this was going to be resolved, because this had occurred before she was mayor. Now she's mayor. These sorts of things don't happen anymore because she holds people accountable, including police. Really. Here's Anjanette Young updating us on the status of her dealings with the city.
And I feel like I'm invisible to the mayor and to the city. They continue to not see me as anyone who deserves to be treated fairly, to receive justice, to be heard.
Wait, that can't be, because Lori Lightfoot said this months ago.
What I've directed my law department to do is, with respect to this one, if there is a pending case, get that case resolved.
Then an apology.
Knowing that my words will not change what happened to you and your family almost 2 years ago, I nonetheless say I am sorry.
Oh, she's the buck stops with a little triple threat, right? I'm sorry, and I've directed. She's in charge. I've directed my law department to resolve this case quickly. So where's the case?
I did believe her. It was her desire that we would sit down and come to a peaceful resolution. And it angers me that she put all of that effort into those gestures and have done absolutely the opposite of all of those things.
Welcome to Democrat socialist politics. Gestures and then doing the opposite of those gestures. I'm sorry you were mugged by reality, Miss Young. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on both sides of this, where the police make a mistake and there is recompense due, as there is to Antoinette Young for what the police mistakenly did, as well as on the law enforcement side for the law abiding. It's across the board. That ecosystem of adults, what an interesting, excited utterance, Counselor Lightfoot. The adult ecosystem in Chicago. Let's talk about the adult ecosystem in Chicago. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-360-A, turnkey.pro text line. The schools, the streets, the business community, and obviously, over the top of it all, the political ruling class in the most hyper-politicized city outside of Washington, D.C. in the Western world. The adult ecosystem.
I thought you'd like that.
Dennis in Crystal Lake.
Hey, Dan, Amy. Hope you had a great Easter. Hey, just to let you know, Amy, look up the incidents on between 147th and 100, where it gets into the Ryan on 57th. In the last year. You want to call the Wild Wild West, I go down 127th every day to go to work. And these people have no, they don't care about life. They see people going in, going out the back door, these jails. They have no, especially that guy in that car with the two-year-old. That, how do you know the bullet didn't ricochet off of somewhere in the car and is in that kid's head? That's what I want to know.
Well, it looked,
thanks for the call.
I mean,
Dennis,
you could see the bullet entry point in the back seat of the car on the passenger side window. But still, I mean, but they picked up 15 rounds were fired between Soldier Field again and Balboa Drive. So,
a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not that far from there. So
no, you're right there.
Lake Point Tower, my well appointed condo, get an email from the condo association. This is like 2 weeks ago, Thursday. Last night, there was an incident near the south entrance. The south entrance, the back entrance to the building is where, like, people, you know, go in and out to take their dogs and so on and so forth, like I do. And there was an incident at the south entrance. Lake Point Tower was a resident was held up at gunpoint. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to that, they put an armed security guard on the southern entrance of Lake Point Tower for the first time, at least I can remember, outside of the rioting. And it's a reminder. I mean, you don't need to remind me, but it's a reminder of what happens when you turn the city over to predators. Yep. And that's what the political leadership, the adult ecosystem, has done in Chicago. That's what they've done. There's just no other way to put it, and the numbers bear it out. By the way, it's interesting because, Dan Proft is just, you know, some right-wing conservative and so on and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In Philadelphia, the Democrat Socialists there have declined to endorse incumbent district attorney Larry Krasner for May's primary election.
Really?
Larry Krasner, for those of you who may recall, we've mentioned him in the context of Kim Fox and some other prosecutors, one of those George Soros-funded non-prosecution prosecutors who wants to reimagine law enforcement, which means not enforce laws. You know, sort of the no cash bail, the no misdemeanor prosecution, sort of the anti-broken windows theory of being a prosecutor or being a law enforcement official. They're declining. The Democrats there declining to endorse the incumbent for his reelection. Now, compare and contrast that to the Kim Fox reelection recently passed, won't you? And just put that in your memory file when you have an opportunity to talk about the adult ecosystem in this city. It's Lightfoot is correct in a sense. It absolutely is. Kids are a reflection of the adult ecosystem. You know what else is a reflection of the adult ecosystem? The quality of
civic leadership, civic and political leadership you have in a particular community. That is also reflective of the adult ecosystem. How we do in Chicago.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. On Monday at the White House press briefing, Peter Ducey, Fox News reporter, queried Jen
Oh, here he goes.
Psaki,
come on, you can say it.
About whether President Biden will continue lying about the Georgia election reform law. He just wanted to know.
But the thing he said has been determined by election law experts to be not true. So I'm just curious if he's going to stop saying that.
Well, again, I think we can, the fact checkers will also tell you that this bill does not make it easier for people across the state of Georgia to vote. And that's where he has concerns.
Right. So in other words, she said, yes, he's going to continue to lie. And she wasn't lying because Joe Biden yesterday did just that.
I think that's up to the masters. Look, you know, it is reassuring to see that for-profit operations and businesses are speaking up about how these new Jim Crow laws are just antithetical to who we are. There's another side to it, too. The other side to it, too, is when they, in fact, move out of Georgia, the people who need the help the most, people who are making hourly wages, sometimes get hurt the most. I think it's a very tough decision for a corporation to make or group to make. But I respect them when they make that judgment, and I support whatever judgment they make. But it's the best way to deal with this is for Georgia and other states to smarten up. Stop it.
Stop. Just do what I tell you to do, and
stop
then everything will be fine. Don't touch my hair. Don't smell me.
Man.
So
that's nauseating.
It's wonderful. So look, it's up to the Masters what they want to do, or up to the PGA what they want to do about the Masters. But I support the corporations making the decision to not do business in Georgia. Or I support their decision to do business in Georgia. I'm just supportive of corporations.
Corporations shouldn't get involved
leadership.
In politics.
It's just wonderful leadership. Like, yeah. He is at the tip of the spear here. I mean, this goes completely unnoticed by the D.C. press corps, of course. Oh, yeah. He just took both sides of the issue. I support whatever corporations want to do. I'm
a
Pontius Pilate. I'm Pontius Pilate on the issue of boycotting. Or not doing business, pulling business out of Georgia. Interesting. Faye Vinson is not. Former MLB commissioner. Good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Rob Manfred's all-star error.
Oh.
Yeah. Politicizing baseball over a law he likely hadn't examined. He talks a little bit about boycott on background here to lead into his point. Consider what he didn't do. Consider what Rob Manfred didn't do, in addition to not resigning from Augusta National yet.
Yeah, which he should have done. I love that you pointed that out yesterday. That's the irony, really.
Oh, it's great.
It's fantastic.
I'm sure he'll limit his rounds at Augusta this year.
Oh,
in
right.
Solidarity.
Uh-huh, sure.
But Faye Vincent, consider what Rob Manfred didn't do. He didn't limit the number of home games the Atlanta Braves will play.
Okay.
He'd need the approval of the players union to do that, and Braves owner John Malone would surely resist. To move the site of the All-Star game is one thing. To ignore union and ownership powers is quite another. Well, I guess, you know, when you have to speak truth to certain centers of power, it's better not to. He goes on this to also ask the question about Manfred's understanding of the law, his lack of specificity, which was pointed out. The talk shows and editorial pages are full of questions. What is the basis for acting so forcefully against Georgia? If Georgia is racist, how can baseball talk of doing business with China? Mr. Manfred failed to spell out specific criticisms of Georgia's voting law. Now he's put himself in the awkward position of having to defend Colorado's voting laws, which we talked a bit about yesterday with respect to voter ID, with respect to fewer early voting days. During my time as commissioner, Faye Vincent went on, I learned that the American people view baseball as a public trust. They want the game to stand for the best and noblest of our national virtues. They see baseball as the repository of their dreams, even as they root for their favorite teams. They don't want and won't accept anything that separates them from the game's history and leadership. Major League Baseball can't become a weapon in the culture wars, a hostage for one political party or ideology. It can't be only for the rich or the poor, nor can it be for only one race, as it was until 1947. Baseball should stand above politics and its dark elements of corruption, greed, and sordid selfishness. It can't go wrong by standing for national greatness. It's a good piece by Vincent. Good. Of course, this is going completely unheeded by Rob Manfred, Major League Baseball, and just about, well, I won't say every, but some of the biggest corporations in America, isn't it? President Trump reiterated his call for a boycott of Major League Baseball. That's what, you know, he thinks people should do. By the way, just as a quick aside, Faye Vincent points this out. I think it's just a fun factoid to know the history of terminology. The term boycott has its roots in Ireland in the 1800s, where a nationalist politician named Charles Stuart Parnell urged his followers not to deal with Charles Cunningham Boycott, that was his name, a highly unpopular British land agent. So that's the derivation of the term boycott.
Thank you. I learned
the more you know. Ding. Ding, ding, ding. So anyway, the boycotting baseball, you know, I don't know about you. It's a rite of passage still, and all Rob right. Manfred's decision, I think, can't eliminate that, nor should it. So I'm not going to get all worked up if a dad wants to take his son or daughter to a Sox or a Cubs game as part of the, you know, rite of passage. I mean, I remember when my dad took me to a Sox game. That's part of Americana. And yeah. I think boycotting that in that way says, well, Rob Manfred and the purgists can take this away from me or my family or this country. I don't think so.
Yeah, but how can we fight back? Because I'm angry. I'm mad. I mean, honestly, the politicization of baseball, you said, for a law that was never read. And did they even look at Colorado's voting laws before they moved the MLB All-Star Game in the draft there to Denver? No, because as you mentioned, I mean, they're similar to Georgia's. You have to show a voter. You have to show an ID to vote, and you have a few less days of voting, absentee, or, you know, I just, the whole thing, because I don't fly Delta, but now American Airlines has gotten involved in this. I'm just so sick of, can you leave politics to the politicians and corporations just stay out of it? Is that possible that people could just keep their mouths shut?
Yeah, I think.
and go about their business?
I think we're well beyond that, don't you? I mean, to me, that's sort of, you hear people say that, like, hey, corporations shouldn't do this, and politics doesn't belong in this particular arena, and so on and so forth. Well, that's a nice sentiment.
Yeah, but everything's political.
It's gone. That's not where we are. So how do you want to deal on the landscape that actually exists versus what you wish the landscape was?
312.
That's the operative question.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line.
Doug Collins, the former Georgia congressman, he wrote an op-ed saying Major League Baseball owes Georgians an apology. Call us for apologies. I don't know. What's a Major League Baseball apology worth? It's like a politician's apology. I'm sorry if we offended you. You're going to get that from Major League Baseball and be like, okay, well,
it's
fine now.
That's fine. I'll go to the game.
Yeah, I mean, he points out the hypocrisy of, you know, the voting rights, the voting reform law in Georgia, and compare that to the election laws in blue states, Colorado. He compares it to California and New York. Georgia has more early voting than either of those two deep blue states. But I don't know. Again, pointing out the left's hypocrisy, I just don't know that it gets you very far. We see it. they know it. They won't acknowledge it because hypocrisy is their privilege. It's their privilege for their moral superiority. That's the approach they take. It's their privilege for being an elite. So what else you got besides pointing out their hypocrisy? That's sort of easy conservative talk show stuff, frankly, to point out the hypocrisy of the left. And frankly, to point out the hypocrisy of those on the right, too, when it's necessary, and we're happy to do that. But that's like a starting point. That's not the QED moment. Because if it was, things would be a lot different. It's pretty apparent. So why doesn't that matter? There's something more, it seems, that has to be done. Isn't there? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Jim in Sheboygan.
So when Kohl's department stores in Wisconsin took MyPillow Guy's products out of the store, you know, I noted it. I probably won't shop at Kohl's unless I really need something there. Major League Baseball, Coca-Cola, Delta. I probably, you know, I'm not going to say boycott. I'm going to say I'll never use their products, but I'm going to keep that in mind when I have choices. And I'm going to remember. And then what I'm really going to do is what I did yesterday, which I helped three candidates local level. Two of the three won. I'm very happy about that. And I'm going to continue to support my community leaders, and I'm going to try and build upon that. And maybe we can turn this thing around.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I agree. Like, so I'm sort of the same approach. Like, I dump my tickets and stuff. I've said before, dump my season tickets to all these sports teams in Chicago. But I'm not like boycotts and this and that. No, but I do keep in mind what people do, and so I'm not going to the extent I can avoid it. I'm not going to patronize or support, give my money to people that hate me.
Right.
I mean, it's just that simple. So I haven't been to a Starbucks since well before Race Together, but I haven't been, and I won't ever go to a Starbucks again because there's plenty of other and frankly better coffee places. So that sort of thing. And with respect to sports, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, lash myself if I watch a Sox game any more than I did watching the NFL playoffs. But I'm certainly going to avoid it. My consumption of those products that I otherwise enjoy will be drastically reduced. And when there is a substitute, it will be reduced to zero of the offending company. And it's just, you know, and maybe it makes an impact. Maybe it doesn't. You have conversations about it with people, and maybe that spreads and makes a larger impact, you know, because 10 or 20% off the bottom line, that's real money for these operations. But I think that's the approach economically, but it seems to me culturally there's a bigger challenge. Sean on the Northwest side.
Hey guys, good morning. Hey, so what I comment is, you know, I grew up watching baseball, football, and basketball. Well, after they got really political, I'm not going to boycott, but I'm moving my interest towards other sports. Soccer. I've never really got into hockey, but
it's not a sport.
My wife loves it, and now we're both into it.
You're moving your interest to sports like hockey and calisthenics like soccer. Okay, just to correct the record.
And rugby and cricket.
All right.
Cricket is actually interesting.
Oh.
Well, you're an English gentleman all of a sudden, Sean, on the Northwest side. All right, very good. Thanks for the call. Shooting sports.
Archery, you
know. Well, okay, I guess that's a shooting sport of sorts.
Yes, it is.
Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys, you know, when AD said, what do we do? We don't have to do anything. Like, I'm a Sox fan. I'm going to keep watching the Sox because they're supposed to be good this year. But the thing is with these leagues, they've gotten so wealthy, and these players made so much money. They're now up to nine-figure contracts. Gerrit Cole just signed a $300 million contract a couple years ago, and he's a pitcher that only plays every fifth game. So when you're talking about how wealthy these sports leagues have gotten, what goes up eventually must come down. And I think the owners want this stuff to happen. They want the woke sports to take over along with the COVID stuff because it gives them justification for when the new collective bargaining agreement comes to give these players less money.
Thanks for the call, Mike. The other Mike, the one in Union.
Hey, good morning. Hey, do you remember when Obama was president, he brought Penny Pritzker in as the Secretary of Labor? You know, they used to do protests down there on Michigan Avenue in front of the hotel, and she was one of the biggest anti-union people there was. And in the USA Today, the AFL-CIO, when asked to comment on what her selection as the labor secretary, they said, well, you know, we'll let this one go. She was a big contributor to Obama. At the end of the day, it's about the money. And then secondly, hey, Georgia, maybe you should have stepped up during the election and maybe got things in order. This is a result of you falling asleep at the wheel on the counting of ballots and illegal ballots. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. COVID-19 pandemic part due? Already?
We're not done with one yet. The horror film's not over, Dan.
That's correct, and they've already got the sequel queued up. And no less than Dr. Michael Osterholm, epidemiologist, University of Minnesota, former member of the Biden COVID task force. Mid-November, shortly after the election, called for a national lockdown. I mean, he suggested, but it's the same thing when you're on TV. Call for a national lockdown of 4 to 6 weeks to stop the spread.
Oh, wait, national flatten lockdown. The curve? It's my favorite statement.
Prevent the surge, flatten the curve, stop the spread, whichever aphorism you prefer. Michael Osterholm is a favorite of that yapping little terrier, Chuck Todd, on Meet the Press. And he joined him recently to say, get ready for pandemic part due because of the B117 COVID mutation. I'm sure you're keeping a log at home.
That's the UK variant.
Yeah, Kent. That's right, in the UK. It's almost like having a whole new pandemic descend upon us. Right,
and please note, this B117 variant, the one that we've talked about, the one from the UK, just as we've talked about it, how it's now 50 to 100% more infectious, it causes more severe illness 50 to 60% of the time. This is almost like having a whole new pandemic descend upon us. The only good news is our vaccines do work against it.
Well, then why are we freaking out, people? Because if they scare you, they can control you. Oh, that is classic.
We have a whole new pandemic. Oh, there is a caveat. We have a vaccine for it.
And it does, you know, control it.
They just can't stop. Yep. They cannot stop with the apocalyptic talk, can they? Because otherwise, I don't get to go on TV and talk to my buddy Chuck.
Yeah, they won't have a job.
I don't get to. Well, they have a job. They're epidemiologists before this. They don't have public status, is what they lose. The same thing with other TV doctors, starting with St. Fauci.
Yeah, and also Dr. Iwarde now and Dr. Nzeke. I mean, they threw out the first pitch at a Cubs game. Yeah, are you kidding me? No, there's doctors turned celebrities.
It's the status they enjoy, and also especially. I mean, I'm not talking about the goofs here locally. People that were respected epidemiologists, respected leaders in the infectious disease field, not the, you know, yokels we have here, for goodness sakes. They're the Frank Robb of infectious disease. They have to, professionally, right? They're allowed because and they're encouraged because of their status to get into other lanes in which they have no particular expertise. Where they do have expertise, many of them tend to have tunnel vision. Not all of them. We've talked to many of those who do not have tunnel vision, but they tend to have tunnel vision. All I'm responsible for is stopping the spread. You know, the issues of economic vitality, the trade-offs, the constitutional rights of Americans, those are sort of separate and distinct, not my ball game. My ball game is just stop the spread by any means necessary. And so the lockdown became an easy thing to do, even though it was clearly not the right thing to do. And that's Osterholm. And that's what's going on with all this eschatological talk from public health professionals and politicians, and who can tell the difference anymore, at least for the ones on TV, most of them, when it comes to these variants. There's another one, too, the double mutant virus in California. We talked to... Yeah, I mean, it's the way they talk about this, it's cartoonish. God. We need a superhero to come in and save us, and then these guys go on TV and pretend they're donning a cape. We talked to Martin Kulldorff from Harvard about this last week. These are not monsters coming to get you. Even Osterholm, you know, buries the lead but concedes we have a vaccine for that. These mutants, mutant viruses, and they're now they got me doing it. Calling
I know
them mutants,
mutant Ninja Turtles,
mutant virus. These. Yeah, right. Yeah. And they tend to be close to as effective based on the limited initial research available as they are with COVID-19, the original. This is where we're at, though. By the way, this is against the backdrop of people trying to get businesses back up and running.
Schools open?
And schools open, of course.
103,000 CPS kids are still not in school.
There was a good CBS 2 piece about a restaurateur, a couple of restaurateurs, but one in particular who's trying to open a restaurant in Oak Brook. His name is Steve Hartenstein, and he's the managing partner of Luca Asterio and Bar, which is set to open in Oak Brook in May. Well, that is if he can find anybody to work for him.
Exciting, scary, and brutal.
He is the managing partner of Luca Osteria and Bar, opening in Oak Brook in May. He has 100 jobs to fill, but at a Friday hiring event, we only saw a few people trickle in. It is far from the large pool of laid-off restaurant staff he expected.
And now that so many people are getting vaccinated and feeling more safe, we thought, fantastic, but it's not that way at all. The unemployment checks and the stimulus checks are keeping people at home.
There you go. Bingo. We have a winner. I mean, why work if you don't have to, right?
Well, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. It'd be interesting to hear from either side of the ledger, employer or employee, but particularly employers trying to reopen businesses to full capacity or get their workers back, and how that's going at present because of the relief, in quotation marks, that has been provided over the last year.
The funny money, as you call it.
Yeah, the funny money. That's right.
They're just printing it, folks.
And that is now impeding the reopening of businesses, and I suspect not just in the hospitality industry, but perhaps particularly in the hospitality industry. And what that means, again, for the lethargic recovery that Chicagoland is likely to experience relative to other parts of the country that have been a little bit more sensible. I'm not going to say aggressive, just sensible mm-hmm. with respect to their COVID response, reopening business, encouraging people to reenter society. And, the other piece that that restaurateur and many others may find, they may be finding right now as they're partially open, is that a lot of people, maybe they notice their regulars aren't coming back, some of them. It's a cultural thing, too. It's not just when politicians give you the green light. You know, you have, again, frightened people and turned people into such goons about some of these COVID strictures because you've just sort of replaced, you've almost lobotomized them.
Right. Well, with
this propaganda. And so they're not coming back, and we'll see.
No, they're not coming back to church. They're not going back to schools that have reopened, that have hybrid learning. And of all the CPS kids, only a third want to go back for in-person learning. Is it even worth opening the doors for that? But that's because they've scared people. And the kids that I talk to, I mean,
at CPS, that's a complicated question.
But their parents were so scared. So a lot of them, They haven't been out of the house since last March. Moms wouldn't let them do, you know, volleyball camps or basketball camps. And it's really affected. I mean, because the parents are so scared, because the politicians scared them and TV doctors, that it affected their children and their children's development socially and mentally and physically.
And I'm sorry, what is the restaurant community like in Chicago doing? Chicago, which was the restaurant capital of the Western world prior to the pandemic. These guys, again, we had Roger Romanelli, Fulton Market Association Executive Director. We had him lined up to come on the show, and then he backed out. I think they're only they're like politicians. They only go places where there's applause.
Well, safe spaces, yes.
And there's no applause here because I think this Chicago Restaurant Coalition has behaved in a generally cowardly, pathetic manner over the last 6 months. And they continue to, asking for their table scraps from the political ruling class. And I get the complications of, you know, I've got to deal with these fuel lords and I wouldn't. Yeah, but you know what? It becomes less and less persuasive when you just queue up for your bribe. And so the press conference today, Chicago West Side stakeholders call for $2 billion in federal funds from U.S. infrastructure bill to halt crime, fix very dangerous Lake Street. Mm-hmm. Right, that the country should pay to fix Lake Street. The country should pay to stop the violent crime endemic to the west side, even the near west side of the city now. Heaven forbid we call for responsible actions from the responsible actors, right? Restaurateurs. What is Walter Burnett doing? What is Triple Threat doing? But you just want a cash out? If we throw some of that funny money your way from the feds, then everything's fine on the west side. It's pathetic. And again, my phrase of the day from Triple Threat, adult ecosystem. Oh, adult ecosystem. The kids are a reflection of our adult ecosystem. So is the civilian, civic, and political leadership. That's a reflection of our adult ecosystem, too. That's a reflection of the adults we have leading different sectors in this region and in the city, like restaurants, who are all folded in with the city, aren't they? Very few are not, as far as I can tell. These are the entrepreneurs who embraced and genuflect before socialists. And you think that's going to work out? You're going to be saved. You won't die the death of a thousand cuts because you're in like Flynn with Triple Threat and the girls and boys on the city council. That's the way you're going to play it?
Yeah, they're willing to sacrifice their business in order to not upset or rock the boat for politicians.
Teresa on the north side.
Yes, good morning, Amy and Dan. You know, if these people don't realize that the ones that are collecting the unemployment checks and the stimulus checks, you know, when that money runs out, and it will, they're going to have to get a job, and then they're going to have to face competition for the jobs, and they may have a very difficult time getting one. So if somebody's hiring, go to work.
Thanks for the call, Teresa. You know, it's short-sighted on behalf of those that are, you know, waiting until the funny money runs out. But you understand. I mean, it's not irrational to say I'm making more not working, so I will continue to enjoy that I'm making more not working. And then when that runs out, I'll go back to work and I guess take a pay cut. But you may consider that you should be thinking about like a trajectory, annualized and lifetime earnings, not having a good old time in this 3 month period. And in fact, to Teresa's point, there's probably a comparative advantage for you to go back to work sooner when you're really in need. That would probably look very good on a young man's record, like winning the caddy tournament. Justin in Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Two things. First thing is I was laid off back in January. I got back to work here recently. But sitting at home collecting unemployment, man, I was making more money sitting at home than I was ever working, and I'm a hard-working blue-collar man. So, you know, these people out there, they can just do that, and they think it's okay. And morally, for me, that's just, I couldn't do it anymore. Luckily, I got back to work. But the second thing is what a lot of people don't realize is all these employers that have had their peoples working from home now and laid people off and stuff, they're realizing that I don't need that 10,000-square-foot office and all these people here working for me anymore. So what's the effect of that moving forward? How many people aren't going to get to go back to work because their employers have realized that they don't need them?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Justin, and glad you're back to work. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the right-sizing of office spaces and the impact on commercial property, you know, I think that will be a long time before we have a full understanding of the transformation that's occurring in that sector in terms of, you know, officing and all of those property holders, landlords. Yes, I think there is something significant that is coming to pass in that sector. There's no question. And it may not be people being laid off either. It's just you're just never going to go back to an office again, or you're going to be there once a week for, you know, a team meeting or something.
Yeah, but that's going to affect public transportation. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
Look at metro ridership. It's a joke. Have you ever seen
what
a movie?
Metro ridership?
Right. Have you ever seen Hotel Rwanda? They're acting like everything's fine. Just keep the trains coming, keep the buses coming, and nobody's on them.
Right. Talk about where there needs to be a right-sizing public sector workforce if you have, for example, public transit with about, 25 maybe? I mean, it's less than that now, but say it gets back to 25% of what it was pre-pandemic, even 50%. What do you do with all of those workers sitting around looking busy? Jordan in Forest Park.
Yeah, you know, has anybody asked Pritzker if the total amount of people getting vaccinated is 70% or whatever, but there's still cases of people dying, there's still cases of getting COVID, is he still going to be involved in all this? Because everybody now knows that they can catch COVID. Everybody knows this. Yeah. Also, everybody knows that they have a choice of getting vaccinated. So what is he going to do? Is he going to continue doing it? And also on the restaurant workers, some people may not realize this, but you can earn money as long as it's no more than 50% of your unemployment benefits, and you will keep all of your unemployment benefits.
Right. Thanks for the call, Jordan. Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I called earlier about the shooting and, you know, the restaurants on the west side. You know, they need to really figure out how to entice people to move into the city. I mean, if you don't have people wanting to move and a desired and an attractive place to move into the city, there's not going to be patrons for restaurants. The convention business is done. I mean, and it's, I mean, why would young people want to move into the city and raise a family anymore? For the schools, for the police protection? I mean, it's instead of the taxpayer should be are supporting something that's working against them. I wish the public, I said it to you before, would wake up and vote properly.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Look, if you're not growing, you're dying. Well, Chicago isn't growing.
We're hemorrhaging.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Since we spent so much time talking about over the last several weeks and interviewing candidates for various local offices, we should probably offer some review of last night's election results in those local elections for school board, municipal, township offices, referendums as well. Amy,
can we start with District 214?
Okay.
None of our candidates won in 214. All of the incumbents remain in their spots, which is just heartbreaking.
Well, then kids can remain in hybrid purgatory forever, right?
Yeah. That's what's going to happen. And because, you know, they appease to the crowd. Oh, no, we care. We want your kids back in school. So they let kids go back to school on a hybrid model on Monday. And the election was yesterday. So it's very disappointing. There's some hope still. I mean, not all the votes have been tallied in District 25. There's four people that
you got to tell.
Oh, I'm sorry. District 25 is Arlington Heights, Wheeling, that area. Right. Elementary school level. I mean,
214 is northwest suburbs.
Right.
As well.
Sorry. Right. That's, you know, it's Hersey High School. You already know that, right?
Sure. Right. Yes.
So that's out. 214's out. Naperville, they did not gain any traction, any seats in Naperville or Plainfield. And there's
how many? Wait, for Plainfield, I thought one of the candidates, the Will County Sheriff's guy, I thought he finished in the money, so to speak, didn't he?
You know what? That's not what they told me, but I don't know if all the votes are count yet. I know Keith Peacow from Orland Park.
Keith Peacow's the, yep. Yeah, that's a highlight. He defeated Dan McLaughlin in a repeat from 4 years ago, and that was a race that I was involved in supporting Peacow with a pack I used to run 4 years ago to knock out Dan McLaughlin. The sad thing is, and this is, I mean, good for Orland Park for reelecting Keith Peacow. That was a no-brainer. The sad thing, the pathetic thing, is how close the race was. I think it was like a 52-48 Keith Peacow win. It should have been like
a blowout.
75-25. I mean, I understand there are just dyed-in-the-wool Democrats that don't have the ability to critically think. But the fact that it's basically a 50-50 town, Orland Park used to be a 60-40, 65-35 Republican to Democrat town. And apparently that is atrophying like it is so many other places. Also, Mike Scott had a key point during his newscast covering the election results, which is the teachers union back candidates.
Yep, that's the thing. They all won.
Because they provide resources, the teachers union, and the teachers, you know, largely vote in lockstep with who their union endorses. There are exceptions, but largely, meaning like a majority. And, you know, the public, generally speaking, bitches, and then they fall right in line to reelect the bitches, so to speak, if you will.
One thing
and
that
I will.
Right. That might pique your interest. And Oak Park, liberal Oak Park, they voted no to defunding police. I thought that was by an overwhelming majority that voted no. So that's
we have to bring up the 68. Waterworks from that one trustee about even having that question on the ballot. Why did she not want the question on the ballot? Because, of course, she was afraid that these would be the results that you just described.
Yeah, 68 of the voters voted no. Yeah, 31% voted yes. So that was a little shocking.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line from candidates or just regular voters out there. Your reviews and reactions to last night's election results in the hamlet in which you reside. One other bright spot in addition to Peacow that I saw was in Homer Township, Homer Glen. Mm-hmm. Steve Balich is township supervisor and the entire Republican slate looks to have been victorious. Homer Township, sort of like Peacow, Orland Park because of Peacow, these sort of little islands within the sea of distress that is Chicagoland, the greater Chicagoland area, including the suburbs. Homer Township, you'll note, Amy, was, I think, the only community I carried when I ran for governor. So
right, your signs are still up down there, too. Yeah,
shows you how enlightened they were, how forward-looking the vision that that community has. Unfortunately, it is not a vision shared by very many communities in Illinois.
And just, you know, back to District 202, that's Plainfield. 9 candidates competed for 4 spots. And Rick Todd, who we spoke to, that Will County Sheriff's Deputy, he is projected to win.
So he was, I thought I saw he was in the top four.
Yep.
And I think Annie, who we spoke with, she was just out of the money, right? I think she was, and was, you know, it's tight, a lot of candidates. It's, you know, you're talking about a percentage point or two, which is why turning out your vote is so important, which is why the unions spend all the money that they do to turn out their people and to keep their people in line so they can have boards that they own that turn around and give the teachers union blank checks as well as dictate to the school district and by extension the school, the families in those schools, the terms of their employment, like when they will come back to work and under what conditions and how long they'll work and so on, and what needs to be done to the school buildings to ensure that they feel safe and so on and so forth, in, you know, ad infinitum, and that's what we have.
Yeah, and just Annie came in 8th out of 9th. So the only new person to get on the school board is Rick Todd. That's it.
And that's Plainfield 202.
That's Plainfield 202.
Melissa in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, I'm in Naperville 203, mm-hmm. and one thing I would observe is, you know, this election was fought in social media. So consequentially, a lot of elderly voters were unaware of the situation, you know, in Naperville 203 in terms of everything that's been going on. And you'd go up to elderly voters in the neighborhood and you'd explain the situation and they were completely clueless.
Yeah.
So consequentially, these people got back in. I mean, the four candidates that did run that were strong candidates, I mean, they received over 3,500 votes. But you can't beat the union. I mean, the union is so strong out here. And another element to this is, you know, our teachers are so well paid, they can afford to live in our district when they're making $140,000 a year. So these people are not only working in the district, but they're also voting in the district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Melissa. It's too bad more of the adults are not paying attention and putting things together the way that Jake Deason did. Remember, he's the 8th grader that dressed down
right,
the board.
That dressed down. Oh, that's right. He should run for school board. But a lot of people did call, too, and texted me yesterday saying, well, I don't have kids in the district. It didn't matter. You could still go vote.
It's remarkable that people don't understand that. Do you understand your property tax bill?
Exactly.
Do you understand the concept of taxation without representation? So in the suburbs, the majority, overwhelming majority in some places of your property tax bill goes to the schools. Therefore, you have a say in the school board. What is complicated about this? I thought that in the suburbs, particularly the well-heeled suburbs, everybody is so super educated and civic-minded. They're all inspirations for all of us mud people. And yet they can't grasp or don't take the time to grasp that simple concept. How sad is that? Oh, I guess that's one of the reasons why we have the things we have, or we don't have the things we don't have in Chicagoland.
Well, when are people
I guess that's one of the
up?
Reasons why Naperville is a pit now. I mean, yes, the replica Rush Street downtown and the Riverwalk, that's real nice. I'm talking about intellectually and civically and educationally. Naperville has gone, you know, full cultural Marxist right along with the rest of the state, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It has. And so tell me again, this renaissance that's coming to Illinois. I mean, I just want to understand how that works for people. Again, I'm always looking to learn, to be informed. So just tell me how it works. What does the Illinois comeback look like? Paint the picture for me. Provide the map. You seed the suburbs. You put up no candidates. And or literally sometimes and of any consequence many other times for significant offices. Like this time, we probably won't see a Republican of any note against Tammy Duckworth for a United States Senate seat. So that's just one example. There are many. And I'm sorry, and what happens? You turn over your school districts to the financiers of the Democrat Socialist Party, the teachers' unions. And you genuflect before these credentialed empty vessels that are the superintendents in most of these school districts. You cede your sovereignty over your children to those credentialed empty vessels and the financiers of the Democrat Socialist Party. And I'm sorry, Illinois is going to become what when? How does that work? We're going to have a deus ex machina candidate that's going to, you know, be Trumpian in their appeal, and is going to turn over the tables of the money changers in the temple and save us all. What are you talking about? What is anybody who believes that talking about? I have no idea. I have no clue. Because there isn't a scintilla of evidence to support it. There are green shoots, places like Homer Township, also Cree Township in Will County, Republicans won. Peacow in Orland Park.
Thank God.
Morley in Elmhurst, but he didn't run for re-election. So we'll see what happens with Levin, the guy that won. Mayor of Elmhurst, see where
the
that
Aurora
community
mayor
goes.
Stays.
But Elmhurst is, yeah, but Irvin has been a complete disappointment in Aurora. And Elmhurst won 51-49 for Biden.
Wow.
So, I mean, what are you talking about? Where does this come? You know,
from
whence does this come?
I mean, it's
delusion.
In Crestwood, the incumbent mayor, Lou Presta, you know, who's under federal charges that he took bribes to promote a red light camera company. He got 62% of the vote. He might be going to jail, and they still voted him in.
I just wish people would be honest with themselves. I get it. I've said it. Somebody wants to say, hey, Dan, I'm here, so I'm going to put in the fight while I can, where I can. Totally admirable. Totally get it. Totally support it. I did that for 25 years, too. But don't tell me things are different than the way they are. Don't tell me that, we need to really rally behind whatever constitutes these surrender Republican Benedict Arnolds that have lorded over the party for the entire time that Illinois has been on the sly to oblivion. Don't tell me that. Tell me you're going to do what you can to put in the fight because you just have that much self-respect. That is fair and admirable. Don't tell me that there is some path that does not exist. Kyle and Woodridge, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I just want to tell you that there is hope for everything to turn around. It's just so far down in the future when Illinois becomes a live reenactment of the movie Idiocracy and we accidentally elect someone smart. You guys have a great day.
All right.
It was an answer.
That I will accept as a possibility.
Oh, there's Rich. Oh.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Out in District 214, what I like to call Club Wellington, won again. Wellington was an old Arlington restaurant in Arlington Heights, torn down.
Oh, I love that
where
place.
All the candidates used to meet and congratulate themselves.
Yes, I met Alan Keyes there. Yes.
Yeah, Alan Keyes, yeah,
remember
that's right
now. He announced that he's running for Senate, yep.
But I think there's hope. I think we need to nominate, I think we really need to nominate a slate of all women. Because the women candidates seem to do better. And we also need to, have the organization. Because we need to go identify people, have lists of people, develop it over the course of several years. Because that's what these establishments do. They know exactly who their voters are. They go out there and they get them to the polls, and they vote every single time. And what we generally have is more disinterested voters who don't vote all the time, many of whom are really looking at local elections for the first time. And, the weather was so nice yesterday that people, they might have, they just didn't go out and vote. I mean, we need to have better organization.
The weather's too nice, so they didn't vote. That's funny.
The weather's too bad, so they don't vote. So I didn't vote. The weather's too nice, so I don't vote. I mean, the excuses. Thanks for the call, Frank. I mean, I agree with him about organizational prowess and being better at the campaign side of this business of government, which is a business. It's not run like a business, and it never will be, but it is a business in terms of, payroll and work product or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's fair, but that requires leadership, that requires division of labor, that requires a point. And I know these are many of these are nonpartisan elections, but we also know what people's sort of philosophical dispositions are. The Republican Party isn't interested in having a point. In this state, they're interested in the people that are there continuing to prey on their dullard GOP primary voters that continue to support them because that's the only Republican name they know locally or whatever, for whatever reason, or they're on the take too. That's what they count on so that they can enrich themselves. They'll go serve their time, have that that title for their epitaph and then flip to go become a lobbyist. Either side, doesn't matter. Continue to get some legal business out of it. I mean, that's what it is. It's a kleptocracy, and we like it.
But in District
2, just admit it.
But District 214, I thought they had a well-run campaign. They were out early. They had their slate of four candidates ready to go. There were signs everywhere, and I thought that at least one of the four would get on.
Rich Menenga is one of the four in 214 Arlington Heights. Rich?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
What happened?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that's interesting as going through the experience. I think that, you know, Frank, who recently called in, and you guys said that, you know, the power, I underestimated the power of the unions and organization as well. Don't underestimate the power of the Daily Herald, right? So if you look at it in our district, all of the Daily Herald endorsed candidates won. The mayor of Arlington Heights, who ran unopposed, endorsed the, you know, the incumbent slate. And I think there's just so much inertia for the incumbents that it's really hard for, you know, people to break in. The other thing, too, right, is to your point, and I hadn't really paid attention to it until before this year, is that our property taxes, the inordinate amount of them that go to the school boards, and that, you know, most of us in these communities don't vote. I mean, you know, how many votes were cast? I think there were like 20,000 votes or something out of 100,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that we all complain about, and, you know, my property taxes have more than doubled. I've lived here for 10 years, and yet we don't go out and vote and do anything about it. So,
yeah. You know, thanks for the call, Rich, and thanks for running. Appreciate the effort that you put forward.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Nicholas Merriweather is a longtime professor of history, philosophy, religion at Shawnee State University in Ohio. And he made some news last week when the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in his favor with respect to pronoun usage. Shawnee State University, where he's taught for 25 years, including a class on the history of Christian thought, refused to use a pronoun that reflects a student's self-asserted gender identity. When he asked university officials about what role his own beliefs played and what he was allowed to say, he was told he must call students what they wish to be called, regardless of his convictions or views on the subject. Well, the court noted, by forbidding Merriweather from describing his views on gender identity, even in his syllabus, Shawnee State silenced a viewpoint that could have catalyzed a robust and insightful in-class discussion and ruled that his case against Shawnee State can move forward. But I fear that is a temporary reprieve from the identitarian mobs in academia and in every other sector of American society today. For more on the subject of said identitarian mobs and the situation on campus, we're pleased to be joined by the founder of an organization called Speech First. She is Nicole Nelly, and she's also the president of that organization. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So how much encouragement should we take from the Professor Merriweather case and put that in the context of what's going on college campuses writ large with respect to free speech and free thought?
Yeah, no, it's a really great decision. It was really well written. And, you know, it's interesting now because we used to hear on college campuses years ago about speech being violence. And then last summer, after all the protests, we heard this phrase, silence is violence. And so you weren't able even just to keep your mouth shut if you disagree with anybody. Now you have to actively parrot the talking points. And what this decision ended up saying is basically, you know, you can't force people to do that. That's compelled speech. That's a First Amendment violation. Stop trying to do this to people. So it's really encouraging that at least the courts have recognized that. What I worry a little bit about is you know, culture lags. I read these reports, you know, incidents that are filed at schools under their bias response teams, which is this creepy Orwellian kind of Stasi Germany thing. And I see students, when they report on each other, you know, they tattletale, oftentimes anonymously, they're asking for punishment. And it's that, you know, how do we change the hearts of men? That is kind of what worries me.
And your organization sued your alma mater, among other schools, University of Illinois, over these bias response teams. We've talked a bit about them. I mean, they're ubiquitous now. I think there's something on the akin of 230. I think that was what Professor Bargosian over at Portland State told us when we spoke with him. 230 around, on college campuses around the country. And these are they are like secret police that set you up for star chamber proceedings at so many universities. So speak to that a little bit and how that legal action against U of I and other Big Ten schools went.
Sure. Yeah. It is, just in case anybody's wondering, your alma mater still does ask you for money after you file a lawsuit against them in federal court. So you have that.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So we sued Illinois. We've also sued University of Michigan, which made my Big Ten heartbeat. We have sued University of Texas, which is my husband's alma mater, Iowa State, and University of Central Florida just a few weeks ago. And we should be doing our next one tomorrow, too. But I can't tell you who that is, so they don't find out.
Well, how do you choose what universities you're going to sue?
Sure. Yeah, we look at this. We have members all across the country, and so we file the cases on behalf of our student members because, unsurprisingly, students credibly fear disciplinary repercussions. I mean, we challenge these policies that are on the books because the policies that are there, like bias response teams, like overbroad speech codes, they have both been designed to and have the effect of chilling student speech. Students are put in a position where they don't know what they can get in trouble for. I mean, the University of Michigan's bias response team, when we sued them, was written that the most important indication of bias is your own feelings. And so I could get in trouble on that campus for saying something, even if I didn't mean to hurt anybody. And frankly, even if I did mean to hurt somebody's feelings, it's a public university. That's constitutionally protected speech. And so for the university to come in and try and shut you down by, you know, trying to scare you and intimidate you and calling you in, like you said, to a star chamber, students make a very logical calculus that, just out of an abundance of caution, I'm just not going to talk about anything remotely controversial because I don't want to deal with the hassle. And so students just are refraining from those conversations altogether. And it's that restraint that we think is a violation of students' rights. And we've had the Sixth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit say, yes, absolutely. So every school we've sued, they've changed their policies. They've walked them back and said, oh, these were already under consideration. Ha ha, nothing to see here. But to us, for schools to have that kind of deference, the, you know, you're caught with your hand in the cookie jar and you're not getting get in trouble, is to me a big problem with a lot of this litigation. Because, you know, when people aren't looking, then they're going to backslide. They're going to go back to what they were doing before. And so we want to also send a message to schools. You can't do that. You're not going to get off the hook.
Yeah, that's a key word, deference, because that's what so many who are otherwise right-thinking people have done in the face of these Jacobins, is just defer to their demands, defer to their mobocracy, defer to their mafia-style tactics and the institutions they create within the institutions. And it's so important to set not only the precedents you're setting through the courts and through the action you're taking against universities to have that reverberate, but also very much like what Mark Perry over at University of Michigan has done with Title IX actions, is take some of what they've set up and turn that against them to show its sort of intellectual, legal, philosophical inconsistency, and hopefully some of these anti-small-d democratic norms and institutions on campuses collapse under their own weight.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about what the Trump administration's education department did when they reached out to Princeton and they said, well, you put out all these statements over the summer saying that you are systemically racist. That's a violation of federal funding. We need to open an investigation into that.
Yes.
And it was just throwing their words back at them.
Yes,
oh,
exactly.
Brilliant.
I read an interview you gave with our friend Mark Glennon over at wirepoints.org, and he referenced your personal history, professional history, and including that you were previously supportive of or involved with the ACLU. And so just a comment on the ACLU, you sort of your perspective on free speech and free thought in a free society and how that initially led you to the ACLU and then led you away from the ACLU.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I was involved with them in college because I very firmly, I believe in civil liberties. My family on my dad's side is, they met in an internment camp. My grandparents, that's where they met. The ACLU of California defended Japanese Americans in the Korematsu case that went to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Deerfield. I mean, I remember hearing stories about the Nazis marching in Skokie in the 70s. And so that, you know, we will defend the rights of our enemies because someday someone will come for you. That really resonated with me. And so to see kind of the, you know, where they have turned into these days is a little bit sad. I realize, you know, they're making a lot of money now, but I think intellectually, you know, the underpinnings have kind of dissolved, and that makes me sad. But, you know, I think it's exciting that there are a lot of other groups that have sprung up to kind of fill that void, because there are a lot of people who realize that these principles, the civil liberties that we care about, are timeless. You know, and they're not left or right or libertarian or green or anything. I mean, this is for everybody. And so when we start to, you know, be hypocritical about who deserves rights and who doesn't, that'll come back and bite you.
Given your family's heritage, you mentioned the internment camps, the Japanese internment camps. What's your reaction to the hashtag Stop Asian Hate over the last several weeks since those murders in Atlanta? It seems to me, and there was a local issue in Elmhurst that is a good example of this, you may have followed. It seems to me that this is just a predicate for people of Asian extraction who are left and anti-Trump to demagogue their race as an issue, the same way that other minority groups and special interest groups within those minority groups have done so, you know, yes, during Trump, but have done so for many, many generations now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think what is frustrating about the identitarian politics is that, you know, these ethnic groups are not a monolith. I mean, I am a libertarian Asian American, you know, and so, you know, I hear phrases like skin folk ain't kinfolk. So I might have the right skin color, but I don't have the right opinion. And so I don't count. And so, you know, that this and as you alluded to, I mean, I think some of this is this cannot all be traced back to Trump. You know, and I think that's really, you know, that's something that a lot of pundits are not discussing, is let's look at what anti-racism as defined by people like Ibram Kendi actually means. They say the remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. I mean, Asians are lumped in with that. Asians are considered a successful demographic. There was a school district in Washington State recently that said that Asians are no longer considered a minority because they've been so successful. I mean, so when ethnic groups, you know, success defined very broadly, it doesn't match up with the narrative, they're thrown out. I mean, I think, you know, how do you lump in a recently immigrated, you know, Vietnamese or Hmong immigrant with a bunch of East Asians who have been here for generations? You know, it's so silly to kind of put everybody in the same thing, but to just assign blame to conservatives, Republicans, and President Trump, I think, is disingenuous at best and dirty politics at worst.
And so do you think Asians are being, you know, attacked more often because of coronavirus, because it came from Wuhan, China?
No, I don't. And I also, you know, I think let's look at where the attacks are coming from. They are not all coming from white Republicans. And that's something that people also are very skittish about discussing. Yeah. Where are the attacks coming from and what is the motivation? Even, I mean, that shooting that was in Atlanta, he never mentioned race. And right. So for that to be spun by the media into something that was, oh, this is an attack on Asians and we're being stigmatized and sex trafficked, it's just you're imposing what you want to on the situation rather than objectively analyzing the facts, which would lead you to a very different conclusion.
There were some good commentaries in the wake of that from Asian Americans about the disingenuousness of the left, just as a matter of course, and so many things, right? It's okay to artificially lower our character scores when we try to get into an Ivy League school, but it's not okay over here when you find our race useful to your political agenda, as you were sort of describing. But I wish there would be more leadership, elder statesman leadership from communities during these times too, where somebody like you mentioned your grandparents in an internment camp, you know, say that some snot-nosed punk, let me tell you something, somebody calling COVID-19 the China virus is not the same thing as being put in an internment camp. So get a grip, learn your history, and show some gosh darn respect for the difference between real oppression, real victimization of people, and this phoniness that you're running around trying to claim so you can have some, you can add some sort of meaning to your existence.
Yeah, there's one of actually a terrific leader on this has been out in California. There's the Californians for Equal Rights. They were the ones who fought against the Prop 16 amendment out there that was going to strip out the state's the state constitution's anti-affirmative action. Anti-affirmative action. And then also in New York, the Chinese American Citizens League. It's one of the oldest associations in the country. It sprung up during the Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 1850s. They have both spoken out very strongly against critical race theory and saying, you know, this is a lot of this is being weaponized against us. There's a war on merit, as you said, with the Ivy Leagues and Harvard. I mean, there are too many Asians in some of these programs. And so we need to single them out exclude them from these programs because they don't count. Our race is being weaponized, or skin color is being weaponized against us when it's inconvenient. And that's a really ugly thing. And so, yeah, there need to be more voices, but there definitely is an insurgent group that is not taking this lying down.
So before we let you go, what else is on the horizon for Speech First, going after these bias response teams, which is noble work on college campuses? What else?
Yeah, we have another lawsuit that we'll be filing tomorrow, so I'll make sure we keep you updated on that. And then I also, in my spare time, have been, I just launched a new organization last week called Parents Defending Education that's going to take on some of the woke indoctrination in K-12 schools. So no rest for the weary.
Yeah, you're going to be busy.
Very good. That's encouraging to hear. Nicole Niley is her name. She's the founder and president of Speech First, among other organizations and other activities, as she was just describing. Nicole, thanks for joining us. Do keep in touch and keep up the good work.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You can win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you have to listen to Cecilia Rouse. She is the White House's top econ advisor. She's the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. And she was on with Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes. I don't know. They look alike. I can never tell the two apart. On MSNBC trying to sell the $2 trillion in funny money for infrastructure. Infrastructure redefined, expansive understanding of infrastructure. You know, that definitely includes roads and bridges, but of course, it necessarily includes investment in human capital, including bringing the shadow infrastructure out into the light. Listen to this.
For what? For centuries, when women were providing most of the care in the home, and the man, this is just traditional, stereotypical, was working outside of the home, there was kind of shadow infrastructure being provided by that woman. She was taking care of the children. She was taking care of their elders. Many women would like to work outside of the home, but somebody still needs to take care of the children, needs to take care of the elders. When we think about our population in particular, over the next, 10 years, we know that a growing proportion of the workforce will be retiring, will be reaching retirement age. But in the next decade or so, the fraction of our population that is over the age of 85 will increase by a third. And we need to be taking care of our elders. Mm-hmm. So, A, someone needs to be taking care of them for women to be able to work, disproportionately women. But, B, we're actually proposing to be that there are jobs that will be created in taking care of, you know, people who deserve to be taken care of with dignity in their elder years. So it's, you know, it's part of infrastructure because we need these kinds of jobs, this kind of care to enable disproportionately women to actually go to work, just like I need the road outside of my house in order to get to my job.
Mm-hmm. So this Margaret Atwood character makes the argument, essentially, if I could boil it down. For centuries, women provided shadow infrastructure, which once upon a time we called raising children.
Thank you.
Now that's the state's job. Welcome to Plato's Republic. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Morning. It's the state's job to raise children and take care of your elderly parents or grandparents. so that women can work. And this is what, in part, is included in that $2 trillion, quote-unquote, infrastructure bill. And this is very forward-thinking.
Well, a couple things. First of all, I mean, the left is really, really good at coming up with euphemisms, you know. So their new one is human infrastructure. And by the way, they want to spend, I want your listeners to understand, so they have $2.25 trillion for the infrastructure bill, which is basically the green energy bill, right? It's not an infrastructure bill. It's basically wind. And it's more Solyndra. Remember Solyndra? We're going to have 1,000 Solyndras under this bill. And then people don't realize, I didn't even realize this till a couple of days ago, that they also want another $2 trillion. By the way, on top of the $2 trillion that we already passed last month for the COVID relief, and this $2 trillion is for this term, human infrastructure. And I was on a Fox show last week, and I was on with some liberal, and she was using this term, human infrastructure. I said, what does that mean? I've never heard that before. Oh, this is, you know, Medicaid and, you know, home health care and child care and things of that nature. And, you know, gee, I'm kind of old fashioned. And Amy, when I think of infrastructure, I think, oh, they're going to fix the bridges and roads. Fix the potholes. But now infrastructure is everything. But wait, there's another great interesting point about this. First of all, their idea is, let's get these kids and parents out of the hands of the unprofessionals, you know, the parents.
Totally.
And let's have the professionals take care of them. Just like, because, you know, they've done such a great job with our 10 to 18-year-olds in the schools, we might as well have them, you know, take care of the kids when they're 2 and 3 and when they're, you know, 80 and to 100 years old. But did you also know that this bill requires that all of these workers be members of the Service Employees Union? And
that's what Governor Quinn did here in Illinois. Yep, he tried to do that too.
Yeah, but by the way, it's even worse than this. Even if you're a family member taking care of your parent and you're taking Medicaid money, you have to join the union. I'm not making this stuff up, folks. These people are freaking crazy.
Well, and this is an opportunity for litigation, because if that were to pass on a roll call on a straight party line vote, the Harris v. Quinn Supreme Court decision suggests that would be unconstitutional. But your point is well taken.
Hey,
this is what they're doing.
When has that ever stopped these people?
Well, it doesn't stop them. But I know they don't. But we do, and this is the avenue we need to use to stop them. What we need to use, the avenues are available. Obviously, Congress and the White House are not avenues that are available.
Yeah, but Dan, you also don't understand these people. I mean, you know, look, we used to kind of laugh on the show and, you know, at some of the dingbat ideas that AOC and Bernie Sanders came up with. These people are serious, folks. I mean, they're deadly serious. So they do, you know, they want to get rid of the filibuster. They want to change the election laws. And I take them seriously. I think they're going to pack the Supreme Court. And then we're not going to have people who believe in the Constitution. I mean, they're out of control. These are like wild animals let out of a cage that are so drunk with power. They want to, you know, get rid of all the checks and balances, all the rules that we've operated under for 200 years, so they can transform our country. And you know, these, I don't know, if you're a Biden voter, is this what you signed up for? I mean, because it is lunatic, in my opinion.
Well, Stephen Moore, I thought of you because Biden's infrastructure plan includes corporate tax hike. And I thought, Stephen Moore's head's going to explode.
Well, you know, Amy, I mean, this one is maddening, too. I mean, we came in. The reason we cut our corporate tax rate, folks, on American companies was not because we love corporations. I don't even like some of these American corporations that much anymore. But we wanted America to be competitive. It was that simple. The United States had the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We talked about this for years on your show. And, you know, the rest of the world was down at around 20 to 25%. We were at about 35%. It was like a 10% Head Start program for every country we were competing with. And we were losing jobs and we were losing factories and businesses because of it. And so, you know, Trump understood that. We cut the rate to make America more competitive. We went from the highest in the world to slightly below the international average. And lo and behold, all sorts of companies and all sorts of capital flowed back into the United States. We had about $1 trillion that came. And that $1 trillion is a lot of money. And so now Biden wants to take the United States back up to being the highest corporate tax rate country in the world. And, by the way, I mean, these people are so devious. They want to, have you seen this one, Dan? They want to have a global tax system. So because they, you know, when they were asked, well, gee, aren't the companies going to move out again? Oh, no, we're not going to let them. We're going to force every other country to raise their taxes, too. The left doesn't like tax competition. I like it. You know, I think that's what restrains government. They've argued for 30 years that taxes don't matter. They understand that taxes do matter. So the way they're going to get around that is to force every country to have high taxes. You know, this is a system of global government that I think we should, you know, be abhorred by, frankly.
I wanted to get your take on one observation about what the next couple of quarters may look like, what the rest of this year looks like before some of these policies really overcome the lag effect and are in force.
Yeah.
This is from economic advisor Joel Ross at Citadel Realty. I remain convinced the economy will grow by at least 7% in Q2, maybe even 8-9% in Q3 once the canal and supply lines are brought back to normal for things like chips. The amount of consumer savings is estimated to top $5 trillion. And he goes on to say consumer debt is even in better shape. There's a huge wealth effect from the extraordinary rise in home values and stock prices. Our hotels, restaurants, more or less fully open. Vaccines, the majority by mid-May. Travel, once again, be very active. The problem remains that house prices are now up over 11% year-to-year, so the combo of rates and costs is going to hold down housing development below what the demand would suggest, and it seems like we're getting close to break point on these home values. So essentially what he sees is there's a lot of good news in the very, very short term, and you're going to have a wealth effect from all the funny money for the next couple of quarters. But come 2022, particularly if the Green New Deal, human infrastructure, tax increases that we were just talking about are passed, then you're going to have the bottom fall out of the economy.
Well, I'm not too far from that in my thinking. I do think, you know, that we're going to see really strong growth. By the way, we had a blockbuster jobs report on Friday.
Yeah.
And you know, I wrote in our hotline, you know, yesterday, hey, Washington, are you paying attention? We don't need any more, quote, stimulus. You know, the economy is healing on its own just fine. The vaccine is the stimulus. The vaccine is the stimulus. The stimulus is the vaccine. Spending all this money has nothing to do with a recovery. And so we're going to have a strong second half of the year, I believe. And then I think there is a hangover effect. I think there will. What I don't know, Dan and Amy, is, and I don't think anybody knows, is when the crash is going to come. I don't know if it comes in 22 and 23. Or, you know, I don't know how lagged the effect is. But this is
well, just on that, just on that score, Steve. Yeah. If I can interrupt, I mean, Moody's is forecasting the stock market to drop 20% in 2022.
Wow. Wow. I mean, that's a big, big correction. You know, I think it could be slightly lower. I think it could be 25-30%. I mean, we've seen these folks. Let's not forget. Unless people do forget what happened in 2008-9 when the United States government built up the housing bubble. Remember that? And we saw, you know, I think more like a 30-40% correction. Don't forget what happened, you know, with the high-tech bubble when, you know, people, you know, some of those tech stocks went from, you know, lost 100% of their value, but, you know, you saw, you know, 50-60% reductions in some of those stocks. So I just don't know when it's going to come, but bills have to be paid. There is no such thing as free money. There's no, you know, debts have to be repaid, and there is a hangover effect. And so I think we're, you know, really hurting our financial future in this country by spending all this money, which is unnecessary. I mean, you're going to see interest rates climb up. You're going to start to see some inflation. I know that there's not a lot of inflation out there right now. But wouldn't it be smarter, by the way, if we're going to spend $2 trillion, why don't we spend it on something that has a – instead of spending money on Solyndra, you know, and you know, daycare subsidies, why don't we privatize our Social Security system and finally get rid of this, you know, pay-as-you-go system that's going bankrupt? Why don't we have a flat tax? Why don't we finance a flat tax at 18%? There's a transition cost. It'll cost maybe $1 trillion to do that. But then we'll have the greatest tax system in the history of the world forever. I mean, I'm not even that opposed to borrowing. What I'm opposed to doing is borrowing for things that have no return. You know, there's no return on green energy. 98% of the cars on the road today, 98%. I was just reading this statistic this morning. have a combustible engine. They're not electric vehicles. We may go to, you know, 90% over the next 10 years, but that still means 90% of cars are going to need gas stations. By the way, did you guys see the left now doesn't want to build any more gas stations in America?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, so my point is, you know, we're going to use gasoline for the next 25 years, folks. We're going to use it. It's a question of whether we get the gasoline from Oklahoma and Texas and North Dakota, or do we get it from Russia and Saudi Arabia? I mean, that's the question to be asked. Let's put our big boy pants on and not have this fantasy that we're going to go to zero fossil fuels. And so I'm just disturbed that this is putting America last, not putting America first.
Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, and Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, guys, have a great week.
You too.
It's human infrastructure. That's the new term for the day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And I mentioned earlier in the show one of the best decisions I made when I was running a PAC supporting state and local candidates in Illinois was supporting Keith Peekow, the mayor of Orland Park, in 2017 when he first ran, and he took out a 30-year incumbent, a hack, political hack named Dan McLaughlin. Well, they had a rerun of that last night, and Peekow won re-election.
Thank goodness.
Happy to hear that. He's been a leader at the municipal level. Similarly, one of the best decisions I made at the state level in terms of candidates to support was Darren Bailey when he ran for state rep in 2018, and he took on an incumbent in the Effingham area. He's from Clay County, but Effingham is well part of the district. Took on a Republican incumbent in the primary who had supported the Rauner tax increase and beat him. And now he moved on to serve in the state Senate since. You know, people think, oh, Southern Illinois is all conservative. Yeah, culturally. But there's only a small cadre of conservative legislators in Southern Illinois that are consistent across the board when it comes to, for example, standing up to public sector unions. There's a lot of Southern Illinois Republicans beholden to public sector unions. They're a problem on issues like school choice and, frankly, just sensible fiscal policy, pension reform. Darren Bailey, Chris Miller, Blaine Wilhauer, Brad Holbrook. That's about it. It's really just about it. Up north, Tom Morrison. That's about it in the Republican caucus in the House, and maybe there's a couple more senators I could add, Darren Bailey being one of them now that he's a senator. And he's not just a state senator. He also announced recently that he's running for governor. We're pleased to be joined by State Senator Darren Bailey. Darren, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's glad to be here.
On one of the issues which you made a mark during the pandemic was being the only Republican state legislator, as far as I can tell, who actually stood up to Governor Pritzker's diktats, his executive orders, and their open-ended nature, and has been litigating those executive orders for the better part of the last year.
Yeah, it's just a matter of being principled and standing up. You know, we wonder if this is some kind of a great experiment on, a constitutional republic. And, you know, sometimes we as Americans, we just have this gut feeling that something's not right. And that's certainly what the court systems exist for, is to interpret that and to offer confirmation most of the time, whether your hunch is right. So I firmly believe that we are under some perilous times, and we've got to get more people standing up and speaking up instead of just complying, as is suggested most of the time.
Well, Pritzker signed another executive order, the 15th one, I believe, a state of emergency. Again, and no one's questioning it. He just does it secretly. He did it April 2nd. And where is everybody? Where is the state legislature? Why aren't you guys convening?
Well, that's what I've been at. So actually, the Senate has been convening the last few weeks. Supposedly next week, everyone is coming in, but nobody's talking about that issue. You know, that's been my a question from day one that the state legislator, if we want to pass laws on everything that's been that the governor has been offering executive orders on, that's one thing. But for one person to stand up and have this power that he is exerting is absolutely wrong.
I'm sorry, what is the point of having an opposition party if you're not willing to oppose anything that the party in power does? And that seems to be the posture of the Republican Party. I mean, they'll offer some cheap lip service in the direction of, oh, well, we need to think about this, or, well, this doesn't seem right, or we should have a discussion, or we're upset because we're not being included. But there's no real point to the Republican Party's existence in this state, as far as I can tell.
I think many times it's the Republicans over time have figured out it's easy to be an elected official and be a Republican in a conservative area, because you could just that's such as the gentleman that I ended up primarying several years ago. You come back to your districts or your communities and you let people know, hey, I'm fighting for you. I'm wearing out that the no vote button. But people are ready for bold, courageous leadership. They are ready for someone of principle to stand up and stand against this thing, because when you do this, people will step up and they'll stand up. But without that, you know, they don't know what to do. They need bold leadership, and that's definitely what I see that's missing.
So to get to the governor's mansion in Springfield, you've got to win Chicagoans. Are you going to? I mean, this is second time I've seen you, I think, in 3 weeks. Are you spending more time up here, and what are you hearing from Chicagoans?
Yeah, we are. We're here this week. Cindy and I have been invited here many times, along with you, at the reopen rallies, you know, open the school rallies. We will be up here a lot after session is out in May. But that's exactly the what has led us to run for this position. The message that we continually hear, even when we're downtown Chicago, there are people that come up to us and recognize us and want to talk, and people are hungry for something different. People are tired of what's been taking place for a year now. So that's the hope, that's the message, that's the encouragement that we've received, and we have decided that we must be obedient to this call and stand up against give Illinois some hope. That's what we're looking for.
But even ultimately, Democrats are approaching you? I mean, do you think you're
actually gonna... Yes, down in the southern part of the state, many people come to our events. So we've had events. There's been, you know, negative messaging against us saying, well, wait till you get north of I-80, 88, and 90. We've been north of those places. We've packed houses. It's all documented on my Facebook page, Bailey for Illinois, and people can see our journey. And absolutely, people are ready. They're tired, realizing that Democrat Party is gone. It's the Progressive Party, and they seek to destroy this constitutional union.
So other than what you did in over the last year and being outspoken against the lockdowns and against the imperiousness of Governor Pritzker, what else sets you apart? I mean, you got to get through a primary first.
Yeah, I think
what sets you apart? You know, how do you represent a paradigm shift for the party and the state?
Right. Being honest with the people, educating the people. You know, and again, you can document that on our Facebook and our web page. That's how I got here. Educating myself on the issues as I've been checked out, because, you know, Republicans, as a Republican farmer in Southern Illinois, I work hard, and they raise their taxes, so I had to work harder. So I kind of ignored politics for a long time. And then you wake up one day and you've got 10 grandchildren and you're beginning to wonder what their future is in the state of Illinois, because the reality is that people are moving out of the state. And I am fighting for our future, for the future generation. You know, I simply say what needs to be said. I do what needs to be done. I've proven that over the last 2 years in the House. Prior to that, serving on the North Clay School Board for 17 years and understanding, how government has hijacked, education system. I've been showing up when necessary or when asked to show up at these Back the Blue rallies. You know, one of the first things that needs to be done. When we get into office, there's going to be a lot of sweeping, bold changes that have to be made immediately. And other than, you know, restoring integrity to our classrooms and making the profession of being a teacher noble again, we've got to clean this slate of this ridiculous law enforcement laws that seek to undermine and dismantle law enforcement. And
just on the school front, I also want to make sure that you address that, in addition to being a family farmer, that you and your wife founded a Christian academy. You founded your own school in addition to serving on the local school board in Louisville, not Louisville, Amy. Louisville.
I'm sorry, I messed up once. Okay,
it's gotta get the Southern Illinois pronunciations down.
Okay.
But you and your wife founded this Christian school. Tell us about that.
Well, so yes, right off the cusp of serving it as the North Clay School Board president, we realized there was a large number of homeschool students out there, and we were concerned about the quality of education that they were getting. And not only that, my son, who was in eighth grade, was interested in homeschooling because he wanted to come to the farm and work in the afternoon. So we honored his request because he's just an awesome young man. And that tutoring one young man in the corner of my wife's flower and gift store turned into two of his friends joining him the year after. And it just grew from there. And eventually there was a Methodist campground on the north edge of Louisville that came up for sale. We purchased it, and we're maxed out. Currently have 180 students there, preschool through high school. A second facility has become available to us 30 minutes away in Alney. We're maxed out there. We go up to fifth grade. And the whole idea is that is one blessing here in Illinois, that private Christian education, you know, the government's got their hands off. Now, with that being said, you know, Chicago Democrats are wanting to encapsulate that like our private, you know, like our public education. But if we can remove government mandates, get the state out of the business of our school boards, and get local elected school boards doing their job and educating their children as they see fit, that's how we can save the future of education in Illinois.
Now, did you guys shut down at all during COVID, or did you had to last March? Or
we did by choice, because actually last March when all this began,
right,
I got on Facebook and encouraged everybody because we didn't know, you know, flatten the curve in 2 weeks. Hey, we don't know what's coming.
Right.
And I actually got a lot of heat from area churches that, you know, didn't want to shut down. But I encouraged everyone to shut down for 2 weeks. 2 weeks turned into a month, and now here we are. So we went immediately to remote learning. We have been open ever since August when the new school year opened. And many schools in our area have been. Almost all private to education sources in Southern Illinois have been open the same. So witnessed very little.
And can you guys go to sporting events? Because we can't in Chicago.
Well, there are sporting events. The numbers are limited. And again, I'm challenging school boards. You guys have this authority. You are local elected. Do your duty and stand up against this nonsense. But people are scared because of the governor's threats.
So one of the things, the one thing I should say, that we have not tried in Illinois since I've been on the planet is conservative reform as the representative for the Republican Party at the statewide level, especially the gubernatorial level. If somebody can name a conservative reform gubernatorial nominee, much less governor we've had in the last 50 years, I'd like to know who that is, because that person doesn't exist.
Well, that's the problem. When you begin to look at a political term of service, it becomes easy to turn that into a career. So, and that's exactly what I've witnessed. When people with bold messages get into power, as to your point, they seem to succumb to the messaging around them, and all of a sudden they want to get reelected, so they start compromising. And Dan, I remember that day. What's it been, 5-6 years ago now when we met and you guys you know, said you'd have our back? And I don't know if you remember what I told you, but I said I didn't know, you know, what you having my back meant. But I told you that day, I said, you know, you don't ever expect to call me up and say, you know, because we did this or that for you, that you need to vote this way. And you said no. You said if you you vote for tax increases, we're going to find you a primary. And you know, that's what I stand for. So we have got, I'm going to be working hard to take back the House and the Senate to see that, you know, that we do something different, because in the past, Republicans have indeed failed Illinois, and it's time for change. It's time for something different, and we need that bold leadership to make the sweeping changes that need to be done that for the best interest of the future of Illinois. And I think we all know that, because no one can sit here right now today and suggest that Illinois is in any way, shape, or form in a better condition than it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, it seems to me one of the things that has to be done, and I don't know if anybody's willing to do it, I suspect you might be, but we'll see, is you have to take on the cultural issues too. It can't just be dollars and cents. And the Republican Party has contented itself with being just strictly dollars and cents, and we're going to take quote-unquote social issues, moral issues off the table. Well, when the left doesn't take them off the table, then you're going to be forced to respond, and then you're going to be on defense, and then you're going to be apologizing, and then you're going to be losing. And that's what has happened across the range of issues and the expanse of the state. So the issues of identity politics in all of its various forms, in every crevice in which you find it, including at, but not limited to the schools and in business community and elsewhere in government, if you're not willing to take on the identitarian thugs, then number one, I don't know that it matters if you win or lose. Number two, I don't think there's any chance you or any other Republican wins. And so the question is, are we going to hear a proactive battle plan and vision on cultural issues, moral issues from a Darren Bailey for governor in the primary and prospectively in the general?
And that's exactly to this point in time. Most of the times when we've been in Chicago, we've been invited to visit area churches. You know, I believe that the church holds the key to turning Illinois around. The church was the key for this great country to be established. That's why we have a moral biblical foundation to our Constitution. 250 years ago, it was the church that first stood up against the British as they were marching into some of these communities. So engaging the church, this whole idea, our command to love others. Unfortunately, and even I'll throw myself in this category, the church has failed to do that, to love others, adequately. And because of that, there's been walls that have been built up. The church has the solution to our cultural and moral dilemma. If they will stand up, get engaged, and love others, that doesn't mean, again, kind of to my point with the school board and government regulation, get the government out of the way of many of these cultural issues. The government has no business being involved in this. The church can do this if the church desires to stand up to love others and be the difference as the church is called to be. I believe the church holds the key to turning Illinois around in 2022.
He is Darren Bailey. He is a state senator from Southern Illinois, Clay County. He is a candidate for governor. BaileyForIllinois.com is the website, BaileyForIllinois.com. Darren, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck. I'm sure we'll be talking to you in the months to come.
Thank you for your awesome messages. God bless you.
Thank you, and he joined us in our Matrix Home Solutions studio.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Tony Fauci was recently asked about the case drops that continue, along with hospitalizations and deaths in Texas, despite the lifting of the mask mandate and the relaxation of the other CDC guidelines. And Fauci took the occasion to just explain his personal mask-wearing policy.
Oh, okay.
And why it's so important to him, what he thinks it conveys. Take a listen.
Don't just stop. Don't come any closer. I need a 6-foot perimeter here. How could you be so reckless? I always wear a mask in my car because my grandfather fought in World War II and I'm trying to be just as brave.
Oh my God, where did you...
I think it takes a courageous individual to boldly wear a mask while they're in their car by themselves. It's a pretty rare trait. We're like the Navy SEALs of the roadways. We're pretty elite. That's why you don't see very many of us. But you do see some of us. Wearing my mask while I'm by myself in my car basically says, I might have COVID. And if I do, I don't want to catch it from myself. Because when I'm in my car, I'm within 6 feet of myself. So technically, I'm breaking social distancing rules, and I don't feel good about it. When people see me drive by in my mask, I know what they're thinking. Thank you for your service to our country. And you know what, people? You're welcome. They're definitely also thinking, he's an inspiration, that's a powerful virtue signal, and he's probably really well-versed on the latest virus knowledge.
He's really concerned about variants, too.
Yeah. I mean, Tony Fauci is slightly less facetious than that guy. Slightly, at least a facetious figure. Tony Fauci's serious. Awake with JP, who's done a bunch of videos on a range of topics,
yeah, he's good.
Yes, he's being parodical. So that's where we're at, as Tony Fauci can't quite explain to the dullards at Morning Joe why it is that the apocalypse has not been visited upon Texans since they lift the mask mandate, why it is that Florida has performed so much better than most of the rest of the country when it comes to managing their senior population, when it comes to hospitalizations and case fatality rates, and certainly when it comes to the vaccinations, and when it comes to the balance between lives versus lives, lives COVID, lives deaths of despair, and not getting the medical procedures that you would otherwise be getting if you weren't fear-addled and so forth. Our next guest is Dr. Pete Bregan. He is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, former consultant at NIMH, and author of the soon-to-be-released COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey. Dr. Bregan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. There's some breaking news, if I may share it here. I haven't talked about it yet in the media.
Please.
About Fauci. Sure. That was an amazing little bit. That really was. You had me going for a minute, too. But in 2014, President Obama said, no more of this making, you know, especially pathogenic viruses in the lab. No more taking the coronaviruses out of bats and making them into gain-of-function viruses, what a euphemism for viruses that can kill people. And when Trump, they then paid no attention to Fauci to Obama, which the press did not get in the new release. And they went ahead and they kept on doing it and doing it with China. And then in 2017, after Trump had been in office for a good part of the year, they went ahead, we now know with certainty, and not only without Trump's permission, but not only using the legal review board, Fauci, along with Francis Collins, who's the NIH head, went ahead and sent hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Wuhan Institute to continue this research with China and to continue making these dreadful viruses. So Fauci is a kind of an outlaw. I mean, he literally betrayed the federal government. He went against the regulations of the federal government, went against Obama's letter on White House stationery saying we have to stop this gain-of-function research. And they went ahead and did it without a designated review board for gain-of-function research. It's like these men are so desperate. It was so desperate to produce these viruses in China's labs that they literally betrayed the president, the government, and humanity.
Why?
Yeah,
why,
what's the reason?
Why were they so desperate?
Well, in our book, we talk about the global predators. And when I started to track down Fauci and then his relationship, he's on the board of Bill Gates, on his vaccine board, and then tracing them through the World Health Organization and China's relationship to the World Health Organization, you find out that over now a couple of decades, there has developed a group of globalists who actually are not patriotic. They don't care about the United States. They want open borders to flood the United States. They're very angry about Trump standing up to China. And the reason is, and I tracked them all on this, I tracked the top, all but one of the top billionaires, all the top corporations, they all have big investments in China. And they end up just like all we see the baseball doing right now, you know, attacking America, attacking Georgia, but then wanting to get franchises in China and praising China and smiling with the Chinese officials when they have slave labor and are the most violent dictatorship in the world. So it's investments in China, and I think it's an underlying hatred that we've raised a couple of generations with of America and of American democracy. And there's no doubt that the people who are creating this whole new concepts of a capitalism modified by progressivism, which is actually just a predatory phenomenon. You can call it predatory progressivism, you can call it predatory capitalism, that these people see America as standing in the way of their global efforts.
Speaking of China, the World Health Organization, which is more or less a Chinese-owned subsidiary, it would seem, at least in operation, they said yesterday they would not like to see the vaccination passport as a requirement for entry or exit because, this is fascinating,
what?
They're not certain at this stage that the vaccine prevents transmission, number one. Number two, there are other questions, equity questions, that would have to be answered as well. And this is consistent with Tony Fauci saying earlier in the week that the federal government won't be in the vaccine passport business. You know, that might be something that corporations do or it's done at the state or local level, but the federal government won't be doing it. So on the one hand, they want to continue to perpetuate their position of power by saying things like vaccine may not prevent transmission. So, you know, you have to continue to have these social distancing orders in place and so on and so forth. And it's a shakedown opportunity for the WHO to transfer wealth from the United States elsewhere. But number two, they look like rather than wearing the jacket for locked or trying to avoid wearing the jacket for lockdowns, as they did when they opposed lockdowns publicly, the special envoy to the WHO opposed lockdowns publicly. Same thing they're doing with the vaccine passports, oppose them publicly because they're going to happen anyway. And then they have some separation to say, well, we didn't take a position on it. It's really not our purview. But if they want to lock down, fine. We didn't take a position on it. It's really not our purview. But if they want to install vaccine passports, mandate vaccine passports, you know, then that's their decision. It seems like there's a little bit of ham and egging going on between the people like Fauci and the WHO and leaders at the federal and state levels.
Well, you know, I suspect they're all in on it together. These folks have been pretty much they're all predators. They're all predators. You know, Joe Biden's corrupt family involved in China, and is the chief envoy on these issues. John Kerry works with the Biden family, and they've been corrupt as well. So I think it's more of a kind of purposeful, let's sow confusion, let's make people so bamboozled about what exactly is going to happen, and then we'll just, and meanwhile, we're just going to go about our business. It's like Fauci in the beginning saying, no, no, you can't wear masks, we need them for the hospitals. Then later on, you know, yeah, you must wear masks, even though there's no scientific basis for it whatsoever. That masks are not healthy to wear. It's like, I think that in addition to fear, they sow confusion, fear and confusion. And the goal, the fact that they are mentioning that maybe private industry can do these passports, which would be totally, I think, against our Constitution in this country. That's just opening the way for the industry and the billionaires to continue dominating the world, which is what these people are about. And they really are globalists, and they really do want to predate. But I want to emphasize something that most people don't know, which is they do see America as their enemy. So if you look at Klaus Schwab and his
World Economic Forum,
Yeah, that's right. If you look at him and you read page 111 of his book, he actually comes out and says we can't have globalism if we have a patriotic democracy in the way. That's America. We're a democratic republic and very patriotic, much more so than other Western nations nowadays, I believe. And because if you have that, then the people are going to vote for their own country's well-being. And they're not going to allow the predators to let China run rampant and steal all the industry. And they're not going to let the predators break down the borders so that American workers have to compete with people in Honduras and China and Africa. They want to open up everything so that instead of capitalism, what you're going to have is, you know, just a wild, we all descend on humanity and we each have our own fiefdoms and we each have our own, quote, stakeholders. And this is very, very consistent. The one thing I found among all these people, whether it's, you know, Bill Gates and Bezos and Buffett, or whether it's the top corporations, they're all anti-Trump, they all want open borders, they all were defending China. They were holding conferences during Trump's stewardship of the country in which they invited the premier of China, you know, Xi Jinping, to come and be a star and to smile with him about recoupling with China. They're desperately afraid, these billionaires and corporations, including our sports industry.
Right.
And I explained everything was going on. Desperately afraid of losing China.
Since you're a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, I'd like to get your medical. Well, Amy would like to know what your hourly rate is, and then I would like to get your expert opinion on this. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal this week that's really interesting. When the pandemic ends, means the return of anxiety, and part of the return of anxiety for those that are not already like fear-addled and anxious because of the lockdowns and the social isolation and so forth. The argument is that people have a sense of control over their lives that they didn't have before, in isolation, I guess, or semi-isolation, but they have a sense of control, and maybe it's the false sense of control, like I'm in charge of defeating this virus, I'm controlling it, I'm controlling my safety, I have more dominion over my workspace, where it is, and how I work, and my kids with the school, and so forth. And they're going to be more anxious because, you know, freedom can be an anxious-inducing state of affairs, and some people would rather just be under the thumb of the state, it would appear. It's just such an interesting approach to the anxiety question, sort of from the complete other angle of the lockdowns-inducing anxiety to the lack of lockdowns-inducing anxiety to some that are ready to serve as, you know, as plebeians of the federal government.
Well, I had not seen that yet. You know, we're in the middle here of just finishing the book. But this is the argument that was made for slavery. The argument was these folks are happier if they're docile, if they're under control, if they're told what to do. This is the argument that's made for slavery. And it also has been the approach of communist China and Russia toward its people. That these people are more secure when they're taken care of, more secure when they've got all their, you know, their fake income coming in while they do their fake work. So, I mean, this is stunning, and I'm going to look it up, and I'm so glad to see you're ahead of me on this one. And absolutely, this is slavery. This is the old argument. It's the same argument my colleagues in psychiatry use for involuntary treatment. Oh, they'll feel more secure, locked up in the hospital. It's deciding for other people what they need. And gee whiz, it always comes out that it's actually what you as the boss need.
Yep.
Absolutely.
First they tell you to wear a mask, and they tell you what kind of mask you can wear. It's got to be multi-layered. It can't be a gator. I mean, it's
and
just
how many
ridiculous.
Masks
and how many,
and
yep.
Well, and you know, for the...
These people want top-down government, and they want the predatory capitalists with a veneer of progressivism. This is really what it is. To just take things over. And I think we need to face this now. It's taken me years to say our free enterprise is not free anymore. What's happening on a worldwide level is not free enterprise versus communism. It's a whole bunch of predators against us. And we have to relook at how do we make these capitalist predators, you know, Like the Amazon and so on, and the people who put Trump out of business from his Twitter, we have to say, well, this is once you get that big, it's not freedom anymore. You are now in a position to dominate. So I used to be a lib. I went from a child progressive to a libertarian, and then realizing that freedom doesn't work if somebody is a million times bigger than you and can outlast you and abuse you and control you. And that's what these big corporations are now.
He is Dr. Peter Breggin. He's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, former consultant at NIMH, and author of the soon-to-be-released COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are can the I Prey.
Can I tell people how to get the book real quick?
Yeah.
Sure, please.
Okay. Well, go to weareThePrey.com, weareThePrey.com, and you can buy the book pre-publication at a very low price. But I've done something, me and my wife are co-authors, that I've never seen any author do before. The minute you push in the button that buys the book at the cut rate in your mailbox, you're going to get the working manuscript, including the one that hasn't been fully copy edited yet. You're going to get a 400-page manuscript with over 800 references describing all the issues I'm talking about in huge detail, because we want to get the word out. So you can get the book essentially right now, but then the real book, you know, finally edited and everything, will come to you in a month. If you can go to wearethepredators.com.
All right. Wearethepredators.com. Wearethepredators.com. Yeah. All right. Dr. Breggin, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Yeah, thank you. Good show.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.